Good evening, and welcome to the local news. Today is Monday, February 9th. I'm Gabriel Zucker, reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, Fortuna's budget balanced with Measure E revenue. California NGOs partnered together to pursue ONRW designation for two creeks in the South Fork Eel River. Stay tuned, those stories and more coming up.
Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Tsingkiyon, Wailaki, Wiyot, Wilkut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection that these tribes have to this region.
Sales tax measures are increasingly being relied upon to augment municipal budgets, and that's the case in Fortuna. Daniel Mintz reports.
Like many communities across the state, Fortuna has localized its budget revenue capability with a sales tax increase that funds city services, and it generated $1.9 million last year. During a presentation at the February 2nd Fortuna City Council meeting, the council was updated on the city's Measure E tax, a 3/4 cent sales tax increase approved by voters in 2016. The Measure E tax revenue pays for essential city services, including police, infrastructure repairs, and youth and senior programs. Measure E Oversight Committee Chair Sue Long said the tax revenue paid for staff positions, infrastructure projects, and general fund deficit reduction. She broke it down in dollars.
For the 24-25 expenditures for Measure E, $422,000 went to Parks and Recs, 20%. $1,102,000 went to the police department, that was 51%. $238,000 went to cover the general fund deficit, and almost $400,000 went to public works.
Police department funding has been repeatedly highlighted during the council's budget discussions, with the wage difference between Fortuna's police staff and that of other cities an ongoing issue. But last November, the council approved police wage hikes in a 2-year agreement, with the increase addressing what was described as critical recruitment and retention challenges. Measure E, meanwhile, is helping cover the cost of hires, as detailed by Long.
Police department has a lot of positions paid by Measure E. The detectives, which have proven to be invaluable. They have solved a lot of crimes. They've handled 1,481 incidents in 24-25. And for two people, that's a lot of cases. And so we added a community services officer, a records clerk, a code compliance officer, which helps with blight and keeping dead cars off the streets and keeping garbage from accumulating on properties. The canine program, which everybody loves because we have the two dogs, Kane and Blitz, and they are very active in the community, helping out with the officers as well as interacting with the children in the community and at other community events. We also replaced the bulletproof vest for the police officers. I mean, obviously, we want to keep them safe. And we spent $67,000 to finish up the police facility this year.
She added, quote, without Measure E, we would not have several of these police positions, and we would not be able to balance our budget. And earlier in the meeting, during a mid-year budget update, Finance Director Aaron Felmley described the budget as being, quote, in a slightly better position than anticipated for this current fiscal year. Fortuna's budget shows a mix of pluses and minuses, and while there's still a deficit, it's less than expected. The budget deficit stands at $254,000 for the current fiscal year, which Felmley said is an improvement of about $125,000 from the version of the budget that was adopted on July 1st. But Felmley described a downward trend in the general fund's biggest source of revenue, sales tax.
So talking about sales tax a little more, which again is the biggest source of revenue to the city's general fund, sales tax as compared to the peak year, which was fiscal year 21-22, this current fiscal year is anticipated to be 6% lower, or $150,000 less. And we also see that continuing into 26-27, with only about a 2-3% increase from 25-26. Spending has not been picking up among consumers since the COVID era highs, and consumer sentiment is trending down, as inflation continues to eat into consumers' ability to make discretionary purchases.
But for the current fiscal year, overall revenue is expected to be slightly higher than projected, with property tax revenue forecasted to increase by 3.5%. Felmley highlighted the better-than-expected condition of the budget, whose total is expected to be $9.9 million at the end of the fiscal year, but added a caveat. He said, quote, "We still are at a deficit, and additionally, the trend of sales tax revenue being flat will continue to increase pressure on our already tight budget." For KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
Today, February 9th, 2026, California Trout, or CalTrout, Trout Unlimited, or TU, CalWild, and the North Coast Regional Water Quality Control Board announced a partnership to work towards designating two tributary streams to the South Fork Eel River under the Outstanding Natural Resource Waters, or ONRW, which is one of the strongest legal protections available under the Clean Water Act. The two tributary streams are Cedar Creek and Elder Creek. If this is approved, not only would it make these two streams among the first riverine ONRWs in California, but it would also set a precedent for other rivers all over California to have legal pathways towards protection. KMUD talked with Reggie Collins, the Vice President of Legal and Government Affairs for CalTrout. He gave a breakdown of the agreement and how these different nonprofits came together to push this precedent.
The agreement started when a group of NGOs or nonprofits, including California Trout, Trout Unlimited, and Cal Wild, were trying to figure out ways to basically push forward underutilized legal tools to protect waters throughout the state in perpetuity. You know, there's a lot of talk about what's going on in the federal government and about losing protections. And so we put our heads together and looked at ONRW as that potential approach, and that's Outstanding National Resource Waters. And what better place to do it than in the North Coast? And so we were looking at different streams and settled on two streams, Cedar and Elder Creek, that are tributaries to the Eel River, which is really critical for salmon recovery. And then the North Coast Water Board is a natural partner that does awesome work with us throughout the North State. And we got together and put our heads together to figure out exactly how we can designate these streams and how we can designate more in the future as well.
Collins broke down what an ONRW designation means and how rivers all over California can use this legal pathway to protect rivers in the future.
ONRWs, or Outstanding National Resource Waters, allow for states to protect their waterways, so rivers, streams, lakes, protect them against any further degradation, meaning any form of further pollution, forever. And so we think it's a really powerful tool. Its power comes from the Federal Clean Water Act, which delegates to the state the ability to designate these waters. And so what it means to designate this is those waters will be protected forever. And we think that there's a lot of waters in California that merit that type of protection.
The pathway forward includes working with the Regional Water Board and their triennial review.
The Regional Water Board has a tough job making sure to check out water quality in all of our rivers and streams, you know, throughout different regions in California, so it's broken up there. And each one of those takes a hard look at their regulations and what they're trying to accomplish every 3 years. It's called a triennial review. And so our process is syncing up with a triennial review process. And so what it means that, you know, we're going to fold our effort into that natural kind of hard look at how everything's going with the Regional Water Board. By the end of that triennial review process, our hope and our goal is to be working with the Regional Board, and they're excited about this too, to have Cedar and Elder Creek be designated.
This is a slow process, Collins admitted, but there is a clear pathway forward over the next 2 years.
Some regulatory process is moving slower than we'd like. We'd like the immediate designation. But we're expecting in the next 2 years, so a year and a half, 2 years, to have to complete the entire process and have them actually be designated. You know, in the interim, we'll be having public processes to make sure everyone's aware of this, so we're not, you know, pulling the wool over anyone's eyes on this one and have a robust conversation. So probably in the next year or so, we'll start the public process of kind of socializing this. And then in 2 years, we'll have completed this designation of Cedar and Elder Creek, and hopefully looking towards more designations statewide.
For Humboldt County, Collins admitted there are conversations being had to push for different rivers to be under this designation. He also talked about how this approach will create a gateway for different groups across California to have a legal pathway to protect the rivers most important to them.
There's so many cool rivers in your neck of the woods. And so I think, you know, the beauty of the North Coast is that there's pristine river systems. There's also river systems that have that run through communities that could use protections as well. And so I won't give away all our secrets, but I can say that we've been looking at the Smith River and, you know, some awesome steelhead streams up and down the Mendocino Coast. So what I would say is, you know, if there's anyone that loves their rivers, we're hoping that we're not going to be the only ones doing this. And so this tool can be used by anyone that loves their rivers and want to see protections long term. So we're hoping this is a gateway for others that hear about this to maybe, you know, contemplate whether they want to push forward a designation process for their special river in their backyard.
Collins explained what attributes of a river is being looked at when approaching this process.
There's a bunch of necessary ingredients to make a perfect salmon stream. One of them is water flow, and another is habitat. They kind of go hand in hand. So are kind of the ability for those rivers to produce, you know, ecosystem services that, you know, meet the needs of fish. So what I mean is, you know, you got to grow bugs, you got to have places for salmon to swim, and you got to have the right temperature and water quality to have those folks, those fish, you know, thrive. And so Cedar Creek in particular has a huge base flow. If you actually look at the, I'll send you over a graph of this actually. But the base flow of Cedar and Elder Creek during summer months is huge. It puts in about, you know, up to 50% of the amount of water actually in the Eel River actually is flowing into that system from Cedar. And so that nexus of having that cold, clean, abundant water, we think is really critical. And so that will be protected under the ONRWs. Other elements of what makes that river special will be protected for against further degradation.
He thanked the other NGOs that are working together and explained how they finally got to this place to make the announcement.
I mean, you can't do something this big, you know, on your own. And so, you know, we're lucky to be in a community of really smart water people that care about fish. And so when we have good ideas, you know, we share them. You know, this is part of why we're nonprofits and mission-driven. And so I would say we absolutely all came together. And, you know, this process, we've been thinking about this, embarrassingly to say, for probably 6 or 7 years, we've been working on trying to get ONRWs designated. And what's awesome about the regional board stepping forward is that they're saying, we're going to partner with you. We think this is a good idea. And we're going to do this the right way. We're going to do it through a public process. We're going to build a designation criteria that works for Cedar and Elder, but can also be a model for, you know, ONRWs throughout the state. And I think you'll see that this is going to be just a tipping point of more approaches where people are using this tool moving forward. So we want to make sure we set the example right. But I think our orgs all work together and have been on this journey for a long time. So we'll definitely be celebrating when we get these designated.
For more information about this partnership and ONRW designations, reach out to CalTrout, Trout Unlimited, and CalWild. For more immediate updates, Collins said to visit caltrout.org, where they have an ONRW blog. In state news, Congressmember Latifah Simon of San Francisco urges dismantling ICE, shedding police for President of the United States. KPFA's Lauren Schmidt reports.
Congresswoman Simon, since we last spoke, Donald Trump signed a funding bill to end the partial government shutdown. That was on Tuesday following a 4-day standoff over immigration. Can you share a general overview on what's unfolding?
What you have seen is exactly what you just outlined, is the administration's attempt to move a huge package, a funding package on top of what was in the big ugly bill to continue to fund DHS, and that's the Department of Homeland Security. And what I have been happy about, even as a freshman member, is seeing finally the House Democrats come to our senses and realize that year after year after funding ICE, even in prior administrations, that enough is enough. And for me, it's been enough. I said yesterday, a couple days ago in the hearing that you referenced, that for 22 years, folks on the ground have been hollering and screaming and begging folks in power to demolish ICE. abolish ICE. And I think now folks are seeing clearly that this institution doesn't just need to be reined in, it needs to be dismantled.
You took a trip to Minneapolis and attended a hearing where victims of ICE brutality, all of whom were American citizens, were either shot at, or attacked by ICE without accountability. I'm wondering if you can share your takeaways from your trip and from that hearing, which have helped you to arrive at your calls to abolish ICE, where some members of your own party might consider that a more radical approach.
Well, I will say this. I have seen members, moderate members, in the past week and a half shift from we can reform this agency to seeing under this current leadership, there's no reforming an institution that is hell-bent on attacking American citizens. Now, I went to the hearing in Minneapolis, and I also visited the site of the murder of, and I will say murder instead of killing, of Rachel Good. I was saying killing, but you know, if you look at what happened there, she was shot in the face 3 times. And going to that site and hearing members of community relent on what's happening in the feeling of that city, what's changed. I keep reciting something that I heard in that hearing that had forever changed me, that at night you hear whistles and screams. Even if you do not have papers in this country, you have rights, and you have inalienable rights, God-given rights. And the Constitution lays it out clear that you too are due process. We know, we just had a hearing, Congress Oversight Democrats. We had a hearing on our campus this week with other members of community from around the country that have been attacked and shot at by ICE, who are two American citizens. It's clear that this is where we are, and it breaks my heart. And so everything that I can do, again, even as a member of Congress that was just sworn in less than a year and a month ago, every tool that we have to hold the administration accountable and to hopefully block new resources from this, what I'm calling a hellfire, because this is not immigration reform. This is not border security. This is terror.
One concern we've heard is about leverage. While debates over immigration policy continue, current funding is set to expire again on February 14th. But as I understand it, immigration enforcement agencies would not be affected by another lapse because of the recently passed big, beautiful bill. Does that effectively take funding off the table as a bargaining tool? And if so, where does that leave Americans seeking accountability for the actions of unchecked federal agents?
You're asking the 20, or I should say the $170 billion question. This is a fight that is going to be enduring. And what's so frustrating to me is that I know that our people are going to continue to not only to bear witness, but endure the hell that has been brought on by the passage of that bill. And it was signed by the governor, signed by the president of the United States. And those resources are in the bank account of the Department of Homeland Security. So you're going to continue to see these efforts. We will continue to sue. Our attorneys generals, legal organizations, and Congress will, particularly in the minority, have to hold this administration's feet to the fire. Elections have consequences. Again, I think the radical notion to dismantle a department that is not doing its own mission is not radical. It's about efficacy. It's about the rule of law. It's about the Constitution. And it's about shutting down what has become a police force for the president of the United States.
And finally, Congresswoman Simon, with the Super Bowl coming to the Bay Area, there's been unease among immigrant communities as DHS officials have sent mixed signals, while the NFL says there will be no ICE operations tied to the game. At the same time, residents are seeing reports of agents being pulled from other regions, fueling concern that they may be redeployed here. What do we actually know right now about potential federal immigration activity here in California, and what should the public be paying attention to?
You know what's so savage about this administration? Oftentimes we're learning about what they're planning when the rest of the media and the American public is learning. They don't share information. They're not transparent. This administration is hell-bent on causing havoc. We have to take care of each other. Mutual aid is important. Know your rights are important. And we have to hope and pray for the best, but organize for the worst. And that means taking care of each other.
In national news, U.S., Iran hold indirect negotiations with the U.S. Admiral attending as U.S. aircraft carriers patrol Iran coast. KPFA's Christopher Martinez reports.
Representatives of the U.S. and Iran took turns meeting with Oman's top diplomat Friday in indirect negotiations that appear to be back to the starting point on Iran's nuclear program. After the meeting, the U.S. representatives Steve Witkoff and Trump's son-in-law Jared Kushner did not comment, but Iran's Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi said on the whole it was a good start. Footage later released by Oman's state-run news agency showed that U.S. Navy Admiral Brad Cooper, the head of the American military Central Command, also attended the meeting, something unusual that has not happened in previous rounds. It served as a reminder that the aircraft carrier USS Abraham Lincoln and other warships are now off the coast of Iran in the Arabian Sea. The talks come months after the U.S. bombed Iran's uranium enrichment sites and just weeks after nationwide protests that convulsed the Islamic Republic. Neither side give a readout of the meeting, and about the only thing they're known to have agreed on is that they will meet again. Meanwhile, shortly after Friday's talks, the U.S. announced a new round of sanctions targeting Iran's energy sector, including penalties on oil tankers in a so-called shadow fleet that the U.S. says are used to try to evade sanctions. Friday evening, the U.S. military published photos on social media of the Lincoln carrier group sailing in the Arabian Sea with aircraft flying overhead, with the message, "Peace through strength." Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
In National Native News, Brian Bull reads today's headlines.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. For decades, Native women and other women of color were subjected to forced sterilization by the Federal Bureau of Indian Affairs and the Indian Health Service. Last week, New Mexico lawmakers introduced a memorial to create a Truth and Reconciliation Commission that would conduct a study into the history and continuing impacts of this abuse. KUNM's Jeanette DeDios reports.
Senate Memorial 14 includes research dating to the 1970s, which shows between 25 and 50% of indigenous women were sterilized, with some of the highest incidents occurring in New Mexico. The memorial would develop a plan to create a state Truth and Reconciliation Commission to research and find all cases of sterilization in the state, gather survivor testimony, and review and recommend educational policy. Keely Badger is a human rights advocate who wrote her dissertation on the forced sterilization of Native women. Lawmakers asked her about challenges finding and accessing records.
I do think that the requests have to come from an official state body, official agencies, to get to the heart of this information. It is going to be more than one person's ability to accumulate this information.
She says this may have been intentional by the states.
At a national level, they have sealed some of these records for a reason. In the same way that a lot of the information about the boarding school system was very, very challenging, took decades and decades of research to accumulate to get to a point where we could have a national apology. I believe that this is one of those situations where it's going to require real political will and advocacy from civil society groups to get to the real heart of this from a national perspective.
If the memorial goes into law, New Mexico would be the first state in the nation to formally investigate and acknowledge these violations. The memorial will head to the Senate floor for a vote, and if passed, will go to the House of Representatives. For National Native News, I'm Jeanette DeDios.
Last week, thousands of members from the White Mountain Apache tribe went to the polls to vote in a primary election that resulted in the sitting chairman losing his chance at another term. KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports.
In a three-way race, Chairman Casey Velasquez earned a little over 400 votes, while his challengers both received nearly four times as much, according to the tribe's election commission. In the end, though, longtime White River School Board member Orlando Carroll got the most votes by a margin of more than 50 ballots. He will face off against Councilman Gary Alchesay in the April general election. Also on Wednesday, the tribe announced that a special prosecutor declined to criminally charge Velasquez under tribal law for allegations of sexual harassment against the HR director. A civil investigation by the tribe is still ongoing. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
The Seahawks, Super Bowl champions for the second time.
And you'll be seeing lots of commemorative Seahawks swag now that Seattle's NFL team has won Super Bowl 60. The Hawks beat the New England Patriots 29-13. The BBC reports that many Native American and First Nations people appreciate the team's logo. Turns out that it's based on a carved transformation mask from the Quaqua-Kewak Nation from the late 1800s. The logo was chosen by the Seahawks manager in the 1970s. Seattle's Burke Museum traced the origins of it to a photo of a ceremonial mask in an old art book. This led them to the Hudson Museum in Maine. The mask was loaned to Seattle for a ceremony of tribal members and team representatives. The BBC reports that unlike other Major League sports teams, the Seahawks logo hasn't sparked backlash because it respectfully borrows from indigenous culture and doesn't resort to racist stereotypes. In fact, some indigenous people from Canada and the U.S. say it's inspired them to learn more of their own culture. A ceremony and parade for the Seahawks will be held in Seattle Wednesday morning. This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Javier Rodriguez, and thanks to our reporters, Daniel Mintz, Lauren Schmidt, Christopher Martinez, and Brian Bull. KMUD News is online. You can find us on kmud.org. And now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media. If you have any questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org. Redwood Community Radio, Inc. is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Gabriel Zucker.